Archipelago is a tabletop game of interweaving tales, of journeys and destiny, of rituals and the sea. I'm Epistory Richard, former coordinator of London Indie RPG and founder of The Pipeline.
I'm Robert Cannell, and the seas are calling me. So we're talking about freeform classic and origin game Archipelago, which principally is the work of Matthias Holter and is kind of regarded as a kind of epitome of Norwegian style freeform gaming, which has had a huge impact, but I suspect indirectly.
Yeah, I mean, it's had a huge impact on me because Archipelago is the root system behind Love in the Time is Safe, which was the first role-playing game I played.
Yeah, so it's directly influenced games like Love in the Time of Seed, which is essentially you can regard as a scenario within the Archipelago
yep.
system.
Yeah, we'll talk more about that.
Yeah. And then there are things like Itra's Bay, which is a particular setting but uses much the same system. And then there are much more removed games that don't have any of the mechanical, quite the same mechanical set as Archipelago, Intrepid, and interestingly, which has stripped everything down to just one mechanic, but since it is a ritual phrase, actually is kind of in that lineage and that descent. And I hope, should there ever be a season 3, I think it would be worth looking at Questlandia, which is another game that's influenced by Archipelago, but is very closed-ended, so it aims at a four-hour game that still has the open setting and the open characters, but is much more driven to a conclusion than Archipelago is.
So one of the reasons that it is so influential is because of the efforts by Matthias to get work published in English.
Yes.
Is it the Norwegian-style blog that took stuff that had been written in Norwegian on their own web forum, which started up around 2001, 2002. They had a series of design competitions looking to create light mechanical games, light story-driven games. And then there was this effort to get some of them out of their country and to the wider world, and hence the Norwegian-style blog.
And I think that's probably most famously paid off in terms of getting Jason Morningstar interested in this kind of genre of gaming. Probably the version of Archipelago that most people know, the one that's on DriveThruRPG, is effectively the outcome of his collaboration with Matthias. And then I think it leads into a whole new exciting family tree of American freeform and heading towards that kind of American freeform LARP.
When we were talking about Fiasco, we talked about how Jason Morningstar's favourite game prior to that was Primetime Adventures, his favourite game to just sit around with creative people and to create a story together. He found Primetime Adventures gave him that flexibility, but then he discovered Archipelago and suddenly flipped to saying, okay, now this is my favorite game to be just exploring stories as a whole. And so he obviously helped out with the subsequent editions of Archipelago and also co-created Love in the Time of Seath, which is very much a introductory scenario to using what mechanics there are within Archipelago. But first of all, with a quick start setting and characters, which are all more pointed towards an obvious endpoint as opposed to the parent Archipelago game, which actually plays quite differently.
The original kind of inspiration for Archipelago, according to the rules, is the Wizards of Earthsea series by Ursula Le Guin, which I think is just I love that series, I love that kind of world, I love the kind of atmosphere that she creates in those books. I'm very much bought into that concept. And it is interesting that she wasn't interested in writing conventional fantasy novels.
Conventional fantasy after J.R.R. Tolkien, for example.
So that kind of 60s, 70s kind of post-Tolkien, just the hero's journey is slightly subverted in the Earthsea novels. So it's not about kind of nascent kings waiting for the challenge that will make them worthy of the throne. It's about people who are probably stronger at the start of the story, then as a result of their mistakes are are damaged, and they become adults in the story, but probably in the way that most of us become adults, in the sense that we bring the baggage of our mistakes and our regrets into our adult lives.
So that's what the designer says is their goal. We don't necessarily always stop with that, with what they've said. Is it, do we think there is a further goals in this game design beyond just allowing people to create Earthsea style stories?
I always think the name is very significant in a way that maybe it's not. So Earthsea is inspired by Polynesian culture and legends. You know, there's a lot of boats and islands and having to travel from one place to another. And people are quite often separated for quite long periods of time, where they form a life in on one of the islands, and then something from their past or person they haven't encountered for a while suddenly appears on the island. And so if you kind of take that archipelago as a metaphor, then instead of having the group of characters being a party who experience things collectively, what you're seeing is the characters are quite often scattered through time and space, and then they suddenly have these conjunctions, which seem quite significant because they're rarer, whereas in a traditional party game, the idea of two characters meeting and finally talking, in the case of Archipelago, that might be the climax of a game, is two characters finally talking about something that they are, about what they've been experiencing individually for like 3 hours or something.
And I can completely believe that, and that's something I feel has been conveyed well in the game, because yeah. It does sometimes feel as though you are just waiting for these characters who you're spending so much time in to actually meet.
Yes.
And then for something to happen, because presumably when these two stories meet, there is some kind of significance to it.
I'm reiterating again, but in the later short stories, then obviously you have these interwining tales where the characters never meet. You know, they're separated by time. They can't possibly meet. So sometimes, definitely had games where it's been quite interesting to see a character who hasn't met any of the other characters, but kind of encounters the aftermath of the other people's story and gives you another perspective on what's happened here. It definitely puts like more of a focus on the world and what we would normally describe as the NPCs than in a conventional game.
So the mechanics are very simple. You either pick a setting that you want to play in, or you create your own setting. There's no actual structure behind that. Is you just talk about what interests you. You each create a character that you would find interesting within that world. It's only at that point, really, that mechanics, so to speak, kick in, where for each character you have all the other players write a destiny point. So that's a thing that they would like to see happen to that character, or they think would be interesting to happen to that character before the end of that particular play session. The owning player then picks one of the offered destiny points. And then that is all public knowledge, so everyone can see roughly where that character is heading towards. Then when it comes to framing scenes, the spotlight player frames their own scenes. They ask other people to play certain roles. They play their own character. And other people's interactions are playing these secondary characters, or alternatively using these ritual phrases.
Yeah, it's tempting to say that they just like spring up perfect and complete in Archipelago, and I think we're going to have to probably dig for their origins, because they are just, if you read the book, you go like, oh, these are really interesting and fully formed, and they work really well, and they give you a structure for players to interact in a GM-less freeform that hadn't been written down before.
The ritual phrases were part and parcel of Love in the Time of Seath, and so I encountered them very early when I did, and then saw other games. I came away with the feeling that these phrases should be in every game. They can have general application. There should be no, especially a GM-less game, where you can't say, oh, like stay with it, or add more detail, or I just need to clarify something, or that might not be quite so easy.
Yeah, so I mean, the key things about the ritual phrases is that they're guidance from the audience to the performer, really, because each scene is framed and more or less performed by the player as their character. I mean, it's one way that it does portray its very early roots, because the idea of scene framing and the idea of setting a challenge or something that moves the character towards their destiny point in later games is almost universally given to another player.
So the other mechanics, aside from the ritual phrases, are fate cards. And these are just basically bits of inspiration that a player can draw if they're running dry. And then the final thing,
and so those do have an origin in stuff like whimsy cards in US role-playing.
Yeah, I mean, thinking about them now, and I've seen them used again in Forsooth, as messages. So whenever, I've never actually done it in a game of Forsooth, but if you run dry, if you don't know what to do next, then you can have a messenger come on and deliver one of these like random messages, essentially, and just get you going again.
So the kind of US whimsy cards were originally designed to allow some player input. You know, sometimes, so they're in a conventional, like, Dungeons & Dragons game, that kind of conventional fantasy game, and if the GM is feeling uninspired, draws a card to inspire themselves, or actually players can draw a few before the game begins and gets a hand of cards, and it allows them to interrupt or disturb the narrative. They were always in the metagame, rather than in the core of the game. There was a deliberate limitation in design that they weren't too disruptive. And so the big difference in the fake cards is that they are meant to stir things up and change the game rather than allow you to kind of channel a minor point in how you go forward. You know, like there's nothing in whimsy cards that derail the scenario, so to speak. That was one of the big constraints. So it's always things that, you know, like if you're feeling stuck, then a wise man stumbles out of the woods and with an arrow in his back. It's that kind of thing, rather than being more forceful, part of the fake cards, which can be more forceful because there's a much stronger sense of the structure of the game that it's interacting with.
One of the ritual phrases triggers an additional mechanic, so that may not be quite so easy. That's a way to indicate that something that someone has narrated is more risky, or there is a certain amount of risk and there should be a certain amount of uncertainty. That then triggers the spotlight player to hand the deck of resolution cards to one of the other players, who then draws one at random, and they are all yes and, yes but, no and, no but, help is needed. And then that player integrates the results into the narration.
So they represent the strongest intersection between kind of theatrical improvisation techniques. The phrasing is very, very similar.
And then the final mechanic is this concept of ownership of aspects. And I think this was most likely drawn from the desire that there be some level of internal consistency within the world. You have one player who has specific ownership of an aspect of the world, and then they are allowed to veto what other people have created if it doesn't jive with their overall vision for it. And by then calling out those aspects, you are then thereby naming the most important aspects of your story.
We didn't spend too long on the world building phase, but the idea is that each player at the table gets to nominate, you know, once you've done the basics of the world that you might inhabit, then each player gets to nominate a thing that they are interested in exploring about that world. So, for example, for Earthsea, if you are familiar with it, then boats and magic and children might be aspects. It's interesting from a world-building point of view, but also it comes, I think, from an explicit desire to remove the GM position from the game, because I see it as a kind of almost a literal dismemberment of the traditional authority of the GM, who represents the world into different components, where each player has a kind of the same authority, but only over one aspect of the world. It distributes a game role between all the players in the game, therefore making it easier in many ways to play a game, because, you know, if you're responsible for religion or how does religion work, then you don't need to worry about whether there's trade between the islands or whether dragons are still alive, because that's not your concern. Because you have that absolute authority, the worlds are never bland or homogenized. The intersection between the different authorities and different statements about the world needs to be reconciled. There can be some interesting tensions coming from players with different perceptions of the world. Again, I kind of think this kind of suits the source material a little bit. So the idea in Earthsea of schools of magic and, you know, like a formal education combining with like the origins of magic, which are kind of darker and stranger and a little more dangerous. You can almost conceive that as like one person owning the schools of magic who wants a rational, ordered, systematic way of doing the fantastic, and kind of wilder, more primal view of what the origins of magic, which is owned by another player. And in a good game, their kind of creative tension drives the world forward.
The one overwhelming feeling that I take away from Archipelago is the sense of calmness about it, of empowerment of the players. This is really a game where you feel completely comfortable telling a story that you want to tell all the way through. You own your character, you own a particular aspect, you direct every single scene. You can take, obviously there's a chance to get input from other people, but fundamentally you are always in control.
The one place where you may have lost at the destiny point, so the destiny point is the kind of the goal of where if your character achieves the destiny point in the game, their character will kind of like more or less fade out to allow other people to take the spotlight. In the session. But then you're not required to work towards your goal. You know, if you feel something else happening during the game, then once again, you're allowed to assert your control and do what you want to do.
It feels a bit like a play-by-post game.
I see what you're saying, but the risk of that is that it just becomes a group of people around a table watching someone monologue for as long as they like. So like play-by-post, but where you have to watch someone writing the post. So I think most later iterations of the game compromised on that sense of total freedom to narrate.
So we normally talk about does the mechanic succeed in the goal that it sets? And my experience of Archipelago games has been that they do fundamentally allow people to create these kind of solo stories with a relatively consistent framework around because of the ownership, with a certain element of risk involved because of that might not be quite so easy. And with an idea that you're always heading towards something significant. Typically, your individual story in that session doesn't peter out to nothing because you have got that destiny point that you're working towards. So fundamentally, I feel it's successful in the mood it's trying to create.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think mechanically, it's not minute by minute. Someone is only really going to call that might not be so easy on fairly significant things. The ownership means that no one can have a central authority or authorship of the world. But at the same time, the very strong individual character narratives can exist because the players have complete ownership over it.
It is a very slow game.
Yes, and if you look at the kind of descendants, you'll see all these ways that they basically use scene mechanics or change the way that destiny points work so that each scene is a stage towards it.
They also do things like Love and the Time of Seath, which have additional roles, so that instead of owning aspects of the setting, you have people owning the temperaments of other characters. So a player to one side of me kind of owns my temperament, and so is allowed to overrule me in certain circumstances, where if I'm playing an impetuous character and I'm being all calm and rational, they're allowed to say, no, actually, you grab the person and you start shaking them. Yeah. And the person to the other side of me is responsible for introducing a new aspect of the scene that is specific to that location. It just engages people more. Unless you use the ritual phrases very often, it can be a very slow and a very passive experience, watching the story slowly going around the table. And it has that aspect of penny. You are fundamentally trying to keep track of 3 or 4 or 5 different stories at once. It's that much harder to keep everything in your head. When you come back to somebody, you're like, okay, wait, what was your story about again? Oh, right, okay, yeah, let's go.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not just Norwegian freeform. I always think that games of Archipelago are best experienced on a very dark and long Norwegian night when you're kind of all gathered in the front room of the cabin with your friends and you've got 8 or 9 hours to like leisurely explore a story in lots of depths and find all the nuance and beauty in it. You know, like I say, that fragmentary, dreamy, short story experience is probably where it's most enjoyable as well. The fact that there is not a narrative drive and there's nothing mechanically that is taking you to a crisis point or a decision point, you've just got to accept that it's one of the aspects of the game. And other excellent Archipelago-based games are available if you don't want that.
The final thing I want to mention in one of my criticisms of Intrepid was the spotlight player frames the scene and then hands control of the scene off to a volunteer director, off to another player. And that director is suddenly thrown into the position of, this person has this idea for this scene, but I don't know really what it's heading towards and I've got to make up all this stuff to go with it. Here, the spotlight player controls their scene entirely, so it avoids that problem because that player can just head for what they're heading towards. But when they call people in order to play these secondary characters, it often feels like it's hitting that same point of, oh, can you play the stranger I meet in the market? Oh, absolutely, of course I can. What on earth is this person supposed to do?
And what are the chances that with no other negotiation, that whatever the person who asked you to play the stranger in the market, that you're going to deliver kind of what they thought they were going to be playing off against?
Yeah, especially if you want to play a shy or a passive or retiring character. If you want to play a proactive character, then at least it gives the other player a chance to go, okay, well, this is what you want, and I can then work out, will I give it to you, will I not give it to you, will there be a cost? If you are playing a passive character and you're wanting to be drawn out of your shell and you have a very fixed idea about what would do it, if you don't communicate that to the other person, then it's more likely than not going to happen. But the problem with that is playing before you play. If you say, can you play this strange man who I meet in the market and is going to ask me to do this and the other thing and this is the way he's going to ask it, at that point it's like, well, okay, do you actually want to do the scene or have we just finished?
Yeah, so, I mean, one thing that the game totally betrays is the fact it was kind of written by and for experienced players who were coming from a milieu of freeform gaming with a lot of implicit social rules that they were trying to make explicit. And I think one thing that can be really difficult with Archipelago is that the cold open, your opening scene is incredibly intimidating because you've got to show things about your character, show things about the troubles that, you know, afflict them, and show some things about why your character is not yet ready to resolve their troubles. So you have all these scene beats that you need to hit in your first scene, and you've maybe just got like a paragraph of character to go on. You know, it's not like a whole lot. And it is one of those things that gets easier, and it doesn't matter in a multi-session set of games, you know, because you can have a relatively small opening scene and you'll get to build off stuff. But the fact, you know, like the fact that there is no like scene structure or scene conclusion does mean that, you know, like I definitely have had the experience of like narrating something and wanting to take some time over it and having another player say, oh, but you've got to introduce this aspect, you know, the mechanics are required, or, you know, something needed to be acknowledged. And I kind of felt like, yeah, I'm getting there. You know, it's like, there's not a ritual phrase for like, hurry up.
Yeah, the ritual phrase is getting out your phone. Just talking about it now makes me think of, well, actually, the right time to draw a fate card is probably quite early on. I was previously thinking about it, oh, it's for when you've kind of got a certain way and you're out of juice, but actually, you need the juice right at the beginning. In your third scene or your fourth scene in that second session, you know you need to be dovetailing towards that destiny point, and you probably have a good idea of how you're going to get about it, so you don't need the help. But they do have this thing, arbitrary thing, where you can only draw one fake card per session.
Yeah, I've always wondered about that, because it's equally strange in Itra's Bay, and I think the fear is, because it is random and it isn't... If you wrote your own fate deck for your own setting, then you could probably draw as many as you like, which is exactly what happens in Itra's Bay, except they still have the same rule. So the game isn't about pulling fate cards. The game is about narrating a story about your character. And I think it's one of those things where the fear that of abuse, of just someone going, I'm going to pull a fate card. Oh, it's your turn. I'm going to pull a fate card again. You know, like, results in something being too restrictive, and I think that is, you know, genuinely somewhere where you could fruitfully look at exploring variations of the design to look at more customed fate decks and multiple draws. It's the safest possible design choice.
One of the criticisms that we made of Intrepid was that it was looking to tell stories that essentially were about, that were based around these quests, but the three scene or the three crossroads structure didn't do enough to support telling those kind of stories. Do you think there's enough in Archipelago just with really just with the destiny point. I mean, that's the only part of the structure to replicate these kind of stories.
It feels like, to some extent, like a conclusion is an entirely optional thing in Archipelago, whereas with Intrepid, it is the game of kind of heroic quests. So it's more fundamentally, you know, it's more
built into that genre.
Yeah, and it's closer to the heart of the game. And you can absolutely make the same criticism of Archipelago. It can lack all the conventions of narrative, of, you know, rising tension and decompression. It can just be one bowl of soup being made after another bowl of soup. And I think it dodges that criticism by saying, like, that's okay if your game, if you feel your character is about making soup in their hut by the sea, then that is what the game is about.
So Archipelago first came out in 2007 and then was revised in 2009, and then there was a third edition not that long ago. And we talked already about some of the games that have been built either on its bones or inspired by it or in that similar kind of space. So it obviously has left a legacy, even without even considering its impact on the birth of American freeform. What should designers take from Archipelago?
So we've already discussed how useful the ritual phrases are for giving in-flight feedback to people who are essentially free narrating. The set of ritual phrases, you've already said that it could apply to many, many games. And I think the ritual phrases are not just things for designers, but actually things for gamers. Think about when someone's playing a scene. Tell them when you're enjoying something. Tell them when you think it could be, you know, do it differently is a really interesting ritual phrase, right? Because it lets you know when it's time to dig a little bit deeper, when you're being a bit trite.
The ritual phrases I talk about as essentially a shared language, as one where, I mean, I'm big on permissioning. And obviously you can use these phrases or you can just talk to each other. You could just say, hey, listen, you should maybe think about doing that differently. But unless that has already been baked into the contract around the table to say that is okay for us to do it, by embedding it within the rules, it means that this is something that everybody has signed up for. Everybody knows these phrases exist, and everybody knows both how to use them and also how to read them. Is that when somebody says, everybody knows that these ritual phrases aren't being used in order to try to help you to make the best story possible. They're not used in order to be aggressive towards you or to say that you're not being good enough. It's all part of collaboratively trying to aid a person to make the best story they can do. And do it differently. I think there is a general focus on that might not be quite so easy because it's the fun one. It's the one where we get to draw cards and then things may go wrong and you may fall off the ladder and into the bucket of paint and whatever. But do it differently, I find, is almost the most efficient one. It's the most powerful one because when you know that everybody around the table knows that they can pull you back at any moment, it means that you can go as far as you like. It means you can introduce whatever concepts and themes you like. You have absolutely free rein to tell the story that you want to tell, knowing that at any point you go over a line for anybody else, they will pull you back in, as opposed to what normally happens, or how I normally feel, is where I progress outside of my unconscious boundaries of what I think the table will take. At that point, I need to be looking around for affirmation. I already, by playing with a phrase like do it differently, I already have that affirmation, and everybody knows they have the tool to pull me back in if I need to be. And so it can be used both to protect certain aspects of the world. It can be used to keep out certain types of content. It can be used to try to maintain a sense of tone. It can be used for lots and lots of different things.
Yeah, I'm also going to make a case for my favourite being like harder or more intense, because that is the moment when, you know, at least one person at the table goes, yeah, this is the thing. This is the thing in this scene. So that kind of like baggy, loose feeling that you can get with Archipelago, if someone uses that, you can go like, okay, so this is the thing and I'm going to like focus on it. I'm going into more detail. I'm going to make the impressions around it stronger. But they're all there. You know, there's not any really weak aspect, and you know, it's like very much a distillation of knowledge. I mean, it's all good in the ritual phrases.
The concept of destiny points is an interesting one if they fit the kind of game that you want to make. I mean, I think about the Mountain Witch and the dark fates of the characters, which all give an inkling of where you are trying to build, and therefore you know the start of the character, you know the end. You don't know it in absolute detail, but with those 2 points, you can construct the journey and you can foreshadow things as well.
The thing that I like most about Destiny Points is that right at the opening of the game, all the other players do something actually quite nice for you as a player, which is they listen politely to the kind of character that you've conceived, and they've gone, okay, the most interesting thing that could happen to this character is this. It's generally a moment of delight, really, when you open the little slips of paper and you read all the stories and you go like, oh, yeah, no, that's great. This is even better.
And there is a certain satisfaction in having your destiny point chosen as well.
Yeah. You know, obviously I'm a professional. I can take rejection. But quite often you go like, oh, yeah, that's much more interesting. Or, you know, like, okay, that's going to take the character in a different direction. You know, like, they're offers, right? And if they're too similar, then the player's going to be underwhelmed. So you kind of want to try and strike out on something you think is a little bit left field so that you're giving a bit of variety when the final thing comes. But, you know, like I say, mechanically they're not really there in the game, they're not really there. And if you know, for something like Questlandia that makes the destiny point central and makes you drive towards it each round, it's stronger mechanically. But there's not enough in kind of freeform games where players do nice things for other players. So that's what designers should take away. Letting players give gifts to players. The most interesting thing is actually the ownership concept, because it's one of the really early attempts to share authority and share world building. If you combine all the aspects and all the questions and answers that have been given, you actually kind of have quite a deep background that is created in hours. You know, something where an individual author has to spend months writing a 200-page source book, and 4 people in the course of 2 hours create all this world full of nuance and richness. And what they've done, the reason it is so rich, is that no one asked a question that wasn't relevant to what they were going to play. That's an amazingly efficient design mechanism. If we have 20 questions about how food is prepared in this background, we know that was completely relevant to the game. And if there was nothing about what equipment soldiers have, then we know that we didn't need to say anything about soldiers. Whereas traditional world building and background tends to over provide background.
So it comes to this. So should Archipelago be considered part of our canon?
So I very much love Archipelago. It has, you know, like a very soft spot in my heart. But the fact that it has born so many variations and inspired so much further game design work kind of indicates that its canon position would purely be one of historical interest. It is, for me, it's one of the bridge points between total freeform, you know, which is literally just a group of players with some mediation rules sitting around a table talking about a story that they share, and the more kind of structured freeform, they link intellectually to Archipelago, which links back to the history of role-playing, which is, you know, like, as soon as we've moved out of the skirmish war game phase, the minute someone had a session where, and I suspect it went back to the Napoleonic war games, where it's like, why don't we do the peace conference instead of the big battle? You know, that moment where there was just, it's like, oh yes, we'll do the peace conference and I'll just tell you what the consequences are. So it's that key moment of completely open storytelling in the context of a background. That's the other side. And so Archipelago links back to that, and it reaches forward into almost all the structured freeform that we see. So critical, historical, important. I'm not sure it's canon.
For me, I feel a bit like the Monster Hearts episode in our first season, where we've identified the need for a new category. Back then we said, listen, Monster Hearts is not going to be part of our canon, but it is going to be a game that we think everybody should play if it all appeals to them. And so we talked about like the bucket list there, and then we institutionalized it at the beginning of this season. And something I think maybe we should consider for next season should be, we need something like a milestone.
Oh.
Let's say that this maybe was not the best expression of this particular kind of game, but it was a milestone or a signpost or something like that, something that opened the doors to, as milestones often do, they open doors, right? Yeah. Mm. So it was a marker which maybe indicates a whole new progression of gaming or a new way of thinking, or was the game that was almost the pivot point behind which people read it and go, oh, I never realized that was allowed. Is that we can talk about Vast and Starlet and say, I never realized we were allowed to just write a game on a business card.
Mm.
And I think games like Microscope and Apocalypse World will all fit in there, that these are games that really helped to redefine what people understand as being possible.
Mm.
But we'll leave that for another time. For me, Archipelago does achieve what it sets out to do, and to an extent, any criticism of it is a criticism of its goal as opposed to its execution. But I do feel as though the experience that I take out of it is one where I am not always engaged, not fully engaged with the stories that are being created around the table. There is always a sense of distance. There is still that moment where I am unsure of what I am doing when I'm pulled into a scene. And it leads to kind of flabby gameplay where you have scenes where people are circling around particular topics, and there are these phrases that you can use where, I mean, I'm looking for the get to the point phrase. But I think it's because, as you point out, it was a game that came out and was built upon by so many other people, and I think because it was so different, I think it's very hard for, maybe not the first game of this time, the first game of its kind, but it's very hard for an early game to be the most effective and the most coherent and the most efficient version of the game, of this game, it could possibly be.
Mm.
But just as in the Monster Hearts episode, we started talking about the bucket list. We now have the bucket list of, like, should Archipelago go into the bucket list?
So I think you should get together your favourite story gamers, or just the people that you like to game with, get in that metaphorical Norwegian cabin, get some food in, give yourself a good 10 hours. I think you should just, like, relish the hell out of this game. And it's flabby, slow-moving, multi-perspective, aimless, wandering storytelling. And you should absolutely experience that.
It is a game, as it writes, to be played slowly and to be savoured, and to play with people who you know you click with and all have all bought into it. It's not a game to impose upon your regular gaming group, that it's a game where you seek it, want to seek out people who were like, yes, I would really like to play Archipelago as well. And so absolutely, if you are in that kind of fortunate position, or you are part of if you have that network of people, then absolutely you should play this game and see how different role-playing can be.
So after talking about Archipelago, I think it would make sense to next talk about Questlandia, which is a game derived from the same rule set, but whereas Archipelago is big, wide and dreamy, Questlandia is much, much more focused and structured and quick to play.
I think we should also consider Love in the Time of Seafloor. We already mentioned it. It's essentially an introductory scenario for the Archipelago rule set, but it has a few changes in there about how you play locations, about how you play your characters, that I think are, again, an interesting development of the Archipelago core.